Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2020, and you're listening to episode 172, which is a conversation about COVID-19, shelter-in-place directives, pro-life principles, and the economy. On this episode, I'm joined by Scott Klusendorf, who is a longtime writer for the Christian Research Journal. Scott is president of the Life Training Institute and the author of The Case for Life, Equipping Christians to Engage the Culture. Scott has taught pro-life apologetics at the graduate level at Biola University and at Trinity Law School. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about his article, which is a Viewpoint feature. Viewpoint articles address relevant contemporary issues in discernment apologetics and cultural apologetics from a particular perspective that's usually not shared by all Christians. And the intended result, we hope, is that Christian thinking on this particular issue will be stimulated and enhanced whether or not readers end up agreeing with the author. He has written an online exclusive Viewpoint feature article called COVID-19, Do Pro-Life Principles Require a Sustained Shutdown of the Economy? Who decides? You can read Scott's article for free on our website, equip.org. Scott, it's good to have you on.
Melanie, great to be with you.
Well, this is quite a hot topic, as I just mentioned right now, not just in the Christian community, but just as a society, and maybe even just worldwide, people trying to understand what does it mean to care about the lives of people who have been impacted by this physically and wanting to help those people with respirators and all those kinds of issues that have been talked about in the news. But first of all, I want to just kind of lay this out because I know we're going to just talk about things so that people understand what we're talking about. I know a lot of people who are probably apologists have looked a lot of these terms up, but I just want to remind people that we're going to talk about the coronavirus, but also COVID-19, and COVID-19 specifically is the disease that's caused by SARS-CoV-2, which is the name of this particular coronavirus, which is there's a whole class of coronaviruses, and there are different flus that fall under this, but this is a much more serious one. And I think when we're talking about pandemic, coronavirus, people are using these terms interchangeably. So we definitely want to make that clear to people that when we say COVID-19, we're talking specifically about the disease that's caused by SARS-CoV-2. So in light of that, why is getting a handle on the science of COVID-19 really tricky for us as lay people? So remind us of the timeline about how our understanding has evolved and changed since January when we first started hearing about this outbreak in China and Wuhan.
Well, you're exactly right. Getting a handle on the science can be tricky. We've had projections, Melanie, that unless we instill very strict social distancing and an indefinite shutdown in the economy, we're going to see millions of deaths. But there have been other equally credible studies, for example, one out of Stanford University, saying that those disease models are dramatically overstated, not a little, but by orders of magnitude. So there's that. Then there's the whole timeline, as you mentioned. On January 21st, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who of course is heading our nation's response to this virus, said that it was no concern at all, that there was no major threat, and Americans should not worry about it at all. As late as February 17th, when coronavirus cases were popping up everywhere, he said the danger was minuscule and that the annual flu was a greater threat than anything the coronavirus would throw at us. Of course, we all know by early March, the whole thing was anything but minuscule. We had the nation shutting down. We had the economy shutting down. And we had people saying this thing could explode way out of our control. And by March 29th, Dr. Fauci was saying we're going to have 100,000 to 200,000 deaths. Then in April, that got revised down again, and now we're being told somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe 60,000. So there's a lot of unknowns, and we're trying to figure out, all right, what does this really mean? So there are a lot of unknowns, you're correct.
Well, I would say that, in the particular article that you wrote for us, you talk about how COVID-19 is provoking controversy within the pro-life community.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do we consistently apply these core principles? And, you know, just because I think into the mix, we've heard some secular voices, government voices, kind of talk about what would be almost a pro-life view. Like, for instance, I mean, I am, as well as a lot of people, are hearing Governor Andrew Cuomo almost every day give a briefing in New York. And the thing about his approach is it's very clear, it's very for the lay person. And he's, of course, also pro-choice in terms of affirming the right for a woman to have an abortion. But at the same time, now in this crisis, he's saying things like, human life is not expendable. You can't put a price on human life. Why stop the economy for 1-2%? Because we're not willing to sacrifice that 1-2%. That's not what we believe as a nation, and we're going to fight to save every life that we can. So with those kinds of things coming out from like a government official, for sure there has been controversy in the pro-life community. So kind of lay out, what are the questions that we're really debating? Because you hear that, and as a pro-life person, I'd say, I agree with that. I think every life is precious. I think that we should care about all the people that are impacted by this that need to have respirators and so forth.
Well, there's really two questions that are being debated. And by the way, Melanie, these aren't just being debated in the culture at large. They're being debated among members of the pro-life community. And here are the two biggies, the two specific ones on the table right now. Number one, do doctors have a corner on how we ought to structure society in light of a pandemic? Or do we need voices beyond the hard sciences? Do we need people like historians and economists and philosophers and theologians and law enforcement experts weighing in on what we ought to do to structure society in light of COVID-19? Or are doctors enough? The second question we're arguing about, and this one is particularly heated in pro-life circles, are pro-life advocates who question a prolonged economic lockdown trading lives for profits and thus undermining their core principles? So those two questions, the epistemic question about who has primacy here, doctors, or do we need wider voices? And then the life question, are pro-lifers undermining their principles if they question a prolonged, indefinite economic shutdown?
So just to restate what I think I hear you saying is that there's two things that we're primarily debating in the pro-life community. One is, what do pro-life principles mm-hmm. look like in relation to this COVID-19 pandemic? And then what are kind of like the ground rules? That is it only doctors and scientists setting economic policy during a pandemic? Or do we need voices outside of those specific scientific communities? And I will say, you know, since probably the Enlightenment, where we as, you know, just in Western culture have started to put things into two different camps, right? So you have things like the sciences, people will say science, and then you have other things like religion and faith and prayer, which is nebulous, which we shouldn't really trust because it's not based on science. So it's kind of hard when you're talking about these things. I think a lot of us, you know, it's been a long time since that has happened, and we've moved more and more to that, to question the spiritual and only rely, like, science and faith can't have something to say together. So that's really hard for people yes. to say, should we let in other voices? So are those really what you're saying, those two things?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. And you're absolutely correct about an implied scientism here that is creeping into the debate. Scientism says that science and science alone counts as real knowledge, and everything else is mere subjective opinion. So if you can't measure it empirically, in other words, if you can't see it, taste it, hear it, smell it, touch it, it doesn't count. So ethics, which you can't measure empirically, would obviously fall outside the domain of what we call real knowledge. And that view of science, which really isn't science, it's a worldview masquerading as science, but that worldview known as scientism has crept into this debate. And that's why every time you turn on the news, the only people you're really hearing from are physicians in the medical community. And you're not just hearing from the medical community on how the disease impacts the body, which physicians are absolutely qualified to tell us, but you also hear from them about how we ought to structure our lives together, what society should look like. And it's their voice and their voice alone that tends to be dominant in the nation's press.
So In your article, you mentioned that the goalposts were moved, and this is muddying the waters in this conversation. And so what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, if you go back a month ago, you will see that the goalposts were, so to speak, we've got to slow the curve of this disease. We've got to flatten it more accurately. And if we can flatten it, we can slow the transmission of the virus and thus prevent our hospitals from being overwhelmed by millions of sick Americans, which would break our medical system. Now, that made sense to a lot of Americans. However, when the models predicting that our hospitals would be dramatically overrun failed to materialize, then the game shifted. Now we're being told that indefinite shutdowns are morally required and that we should never put lives above profits and that we're obligated to extend these lockdowns until we beat the virus itself. So there's the change, Melanie. We started with, hey, we're out to flatten the curve. We're out to slow the transmission. This will be a temporary shutdown. We're just trying to make sure our hospital staffs and institutions can get ahead of this. That's all we're trying to do. But then when we didn't get overwhelmed, when our hospitals weren't packed out with millions of sick Americans, then the game changed. Now we have to beat the disease itself. And as Dr. Fauci has said, hey, the only way we can beat the disease is with a vaccine. Well, that could be a year or more away. So the game plan has now changed, and I'm not sure how many Americans have noticed the shift.
Well, to that, wouldn't Dr. Fauci's camp say that the reason why the hospitals are not overwhelmed is because this shutdown is working? We are flattening the curve, and so we need to stay the course to keep continuing to do this so that if we go back to quote-unquote life as it was, then we will see this peak again. We will have a second wave or a third wave or more. And then once again, we will overwhelm the healthcare system.
Well, the problem with that is he has a self-sealing argument that can be never criticized, because if we don't get the number of deaths that we were told, the hundreds of thousands, he can say, see, the policy of social distancing worked. And that means that no matter what happens here, he wins in terms of an explanation. If it doesn't work, if we did have the high numbers of deaths, he would say, see, if you would listen to me, we wouldn't have had them. Here's the problem, I think, with this. He has still, and he's not the only one, I don't want to pick only on him here, but the medical professionals have changed the debate. We shifted from flattening the curve to we've got to beat this disease. They told us initially it was going to be temporary. Now they're telling us, hey, it could be indefinite and we cannot go back to normal until we have beaten this thing in total with a vaccine. They changed the rules there.
I do want to mention that Dr. Fauci and Dr. Brix know each other from their research for HIV/AIDS.
Yes.
And when that came along in the 1980s, we still don't have a vaccine and it's now 30 years later. So
yeah.
We don't know if we will definitely have a vaccine. And also when we talk about getting a flu shot too, as someone who definitely I have and my family always gets the flu shot, you know, some years they have different strains and they get it right. And other years they don't get it right. So I would think that it would be an ongoing process for some kind of immunization with it, because if it falls into that same class of coronavirus and we don't know also if it'll mutate and so forth,
right?
Those are considerations.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Scott Klusendorf, who has written an online feature-length viewpoint opinion piece called COVID-19, Do Pro-Life Principles Require a Sustained Shutdown of the Economy? Who Decides? You can read Scott's article for free on our website, equip.org. Now it is April 2020. We are still in the midst of pretty much a nationwide shutdown in the United States for this pandemic. And so we understand that right now, economically, a lot of people are not in position to get a subscription to the Christian Research Journal. But if you are and you can bless someone, we'd like to suggest you give someone a gift subscription, which you can do for $33.50 at our website, equip.org. But one way that everyone can help us that we'd really, really appreciate is could you please give us a starred or written review at Apple Podcasts? It's very easy. Starred review just will take literally seconds. But if you can spare a few more minutes, please do write us a written review. And when you have done that, we are so grateful because those written reviews and those starred reviews help more people find our content. And if more people find our content, it's a way that you can help us to continue to produce this free content for you. And so we thank you for your partnership. You can also do this wherever else you get your podcasts. It might be on Google Play or Spreaker or wherever else that it is, but please do give us a written review. Thanks.
Well, before we get started into talking about some specifics in your article, let's define terms. Specifically, what do you mean by pro-life? Because I mean, my little kind of description of it is I would consider myself pro-life from conception to natural birth. But describe what you mean by pro-life, because most of the time people are only thinking about that with regards to the abortion debate. And some other pro-life apologists would say, well, here again, it's the people who are in that community that only apply it to abortion, not to lives outside the womb, that are arguing for the fact that we should open up the economy, and they're not valuing the lives of all those who are dying from this and are impacted.
Yeah. Well, whether pro-life means more than abortion is somewhat of a separate debate, but you're right about one thing. We do need to define what it means, because if we don't, we can't apply pro-life principles correctly to this COVID-19 outbreak. So let me define what pro-life is. Pro-life means you will never support policies that intentionally kill innocent human beings. To give it to you in a syllogism, premise one would be it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Abortion, doctor-assisted suicide, fetal tissue research, embryonic stem cell research, all intentionally kill innocent human beings. Therefore, those things would be wrong. So applied to COVID-19, no pro-lifer is going to support a policy, even if it helps us in a pandemic, if what we're talking about is intentionally killing innocent human beings. We must always oppose that, and we must oppose it on grounds that any law that permits killing innocent human beings, intentionally killing innocent human beings, is scandalous on the face of it. So we can never support any policy that's going to do that, that will intentionally kill innocent human beings. However, it doesn't follow from that that pro-life means you must oppose any case where you can foresee death happening but not intend it. And so we've got to be careful that we define what we mean by pro-life carefully. For example, I can foresee that driving to work could put some lives at risk. My own, maybe an innocent old lady on the road if I'm not paying attention, maybe a pedestrian that I accidentally hit, but it doesn't follow that I intend those deaths, and it doesn't follow I'm putting profits above lives by driving to work to make money when there's a risk that some innocent people might die. So again, pro-life is I will never support a policy that intentionally kills innocent human beings.
Of course, as we mentioned earlier in our conversation, not all pro-life apologists are agreeing with your point of view.
Correct.
Here. And there are some that you're quoting in your article. And basically, as you just mentioned, their argument basically boils down to life above profits. And
yeah.
So why would any pro-lifer disagree with that? And you say that they're poisoning the well. And then also, there are some apologists who would say, you don't simply let people out of this economic shutdown because simply there's this hypothetical amount of people that might be depressed and might be commit suicide. And we don't know that. But we do know that if we lift all of these different shutdowns right away, that we will be putting many people in harm's way. And they would maybe argue intentionally because we know how lethal this virus is. We know how just what happens to people when they get it, but also how incredibly contagious it is, that there's asymptomatic people that are spreading it and so forth. And so how do you answer that?
Well, let me begin by saying that some people, not all, some critics of my position poison the well in their response to what I say. So, for example, there is a professor at Wheaton that argues that it can only be from a depraved mind that you would argue we should lift these shelter-in-place restrictions and let people go back to work. And her basic argument that she posted on social media was that when you say to people, hey, we're willing to intentionally sacrifice innocent human lives so we can get the economy going again, there's no other way to describe that moral calculus, she says, other than totally depraved. And when you put it that way, you're poisoning the well against any possible counterargument that might say, wait a minute. And here's where I would say, wait a minute. Pro-lifers are not callously choosing money over people. We're asking how we can save the most lives and preserve the common good given the pandemic we've been dealt. So really what this professor is doing at Wheaton is presenting a false choice and attributing to her opponents the worst possible motives. And where I think they make the mistake, Melanie, is they misunderstand the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle is a very sound view of how we approach situations like this, and virtually everybody agrees that it's in play here. Here's the precautionary principle. We should always act to minimize the probability of an extreme catastrophic result, which it's easy to see what that would be in this case. It's the widespread loss of life from the virus. And we ought to do everything we can to bring that extreme probability as close to zero as possible. And of course, a shelter-in-place directive certainly is consistent with that principle, no doubt about it. But contra that professor at Wheaton and others, the precautionary principle actually points more than one direction here. Shutting down an entire nation for a prolonged period of time and wiping out its economy has catastrophic impact on the common good and results in deaths from other things, which we'll get to, I'm sure, in a moment. So when we talk about this, it's not a simple choice, lives versus profits. There's more to it than that. And I think what happens is when you say life above profits, you're failing to account for the complexity in the precautionary principle. And that presents everybody with a false choice.
You've also said in light of that, that lives over profits results in an absurdity. How would you say that? Because, I mean, again, I think people would say what we're trying to do is we're not, you're trying to say, well, what's good for, it's very Darwinian. What's good for the majority of the people, and we're going to lose some people in the process. So that's what the way it is.
Well, if lives over profits is the rule, then we've got some real problems, and it doesn't work in the real world. I mean, like I said earlier, should we ban driving to work because we value life over profits? 38,000 Americans die every year in car wrecks. Staying home is always safer than venturing out to provide a living for my family. But I think the biggest absurdity here is this. If life over profits is the governing principle here, then we can never end these economic shutdowns, because no matter where we ease economic restrictions, we will at that exact point unintentionally put certain vulnerable people at risk. What I'm arguing is the long-term alternative is far, far worse. And where I think the professor at Wheaton gets it wrong, no pro-lifer I know that's concerned about the economy wants us to intentionally harm innocent human beings. We would never go for that, as I mentioned earlier. Rather, what we're saying is we can envision situations, and we think the current situation we're in fits this, where we can foresee the death of innocent human beings, but we do not intend it. In other words, in life, there will always be dangers. Walking outside of my house is a danger. There will always be dangers, but we accept reasonable trade-offs for the overall good. That's not sacrificing lives for profits. That's saying it's better for the common good of humanity, to help humanity flourish, that we not eliminate every possibility where someone might unintentionally die.
But I think some people would argue that it's not the same thing as, of course, there's risks, and that's why people are actuaries and get degrees in math, because they want to help insurance companies figure out, well, what is the probability of hurricanes or car accidents or so forth? But at the same time, I mean, the probability if you're near someone sick who is shedding the virus, who's asymptomatic, it's much more possible that you will contract this disease. Now, we don't know if you're going to contract it, that if you get COVID-19, are you going to be in the group that dies from this? Are you going to be in the group that becomes another asymptomatic carrier? We don't know. But I think some would say, how can you use those as examples? Because they're not the same quote unquote danger level, well, I guess.
Yeah, I actually think that we got to go back to what my thesis was at the beginning, what we began with. Given the unknowns of the disease, it is not inconsistent with pro-life principles to say we ought to look at restarting the economy. So far, I think everyone will agree that this virus has underperformed in light of the most extreme estimates we were giving. We're coming nowhere near that. And we don't have any evidence at the moment that we're going to see a worldwide breakout with catastrophic numbers. That doesn't mean those people who die from this didn't die terrible deaths. It doesn't mean there is no risk. But we are all forced to make prudential calculations on this. And my modest thesis is you're not violating your pro-life principles if you land on the side of, hey, we ought to jumpstart this economy again because we're going to lose more lives in the process than if we don't. That debate over which is more deadly, this virus or leaving the economy shut down, that debate is one of prudence, not a sacrifice of moral principle.
I want to go back to something we started talking about at the beginning of our conversation. The first part of your article addresses the authority question. We talked about this, like who should be setting economic policy, doctors and scientists who understand the nature of the disease and its effects, or should some of those people part of the discussion include experts from different academic disciplines? You mentioned ethicists and theologians and people in the liberal arts and the humanities and so forth.
Yeah.
And you say that a prolonged shutdown of the economy puts vulnerable people at risk and raise a whole host of troubling questions. And so what are some of those questions and why can't doctors handle them? And I would say because of what we said earlier in terms of how entrenched we are as a society with a scientific worldview trumping over any other kind of input from other places that we consider spiritual and therefore not reliable, it's hard for people to understand the value of why that would be to add those people like economists. And you see that very clearly in the news. And it's kind of interesting. I've even seen, you know, everyone gets those spam emails for different things. And so some of the clothing companies have pivoted and they're doing all these like pro Fauci t-shirts that you can wear. And one of them says on it, "In Fauci, we trust." So it seems that people would trust more in Dr. Fauci and Dr. Bricks and science than thinking that why would we add economists? They don't know what they're talking about. They're not scientists.
Right. Well, let's be fair here and give credit where credit is due. Is Dr. Fauci qualified to tell us how COVID-19 works on the body and what the best treatments are for reversing the virus on the human body? And the answer is absolutely, far more qualified than me, far more qualified than an economist, a theologian, a philosopher, or a law enforcement official. No doubt about it. When it comes to the practice of medicine and how certain viruses and illnesses relate to the human body, doctors have primacy. No doubt. That's their field of specialty. But they don't have primacy in areas outside of that. They have no more authority than anyone else to tell us how we ought to structure society in light of a pandemic. And here's the danger, Melanie, and I think it's a significant one. Doctors who would never allow an experimental treatment until it was thoroughly tested by the FDA for years are quite willing to step outside their field of expertise and demand untested and draconian economic policies that are going to harm vulnerable Americans and impoverish the nation. And if we look at the troubling questions we're being confronted with right now, it's not hard to see how they fall outside the realm of the hard sciences. So let me just give you a few of those questions. To what extent do sustained unemployment and increased poverty endanger human life and undermine the rule of law? I'll have something to say about that as we go along. Another question is, as families are going hungry, how many lives are going to be lost to civil unrest? What will happen to our institutions that help restrain evil, political, social, and religious? Will the destruction of personal income lead to more deaths from drug and alcohol abuse? And there's quite a bit of evidence on that right now. Will massive unemployment impact mental health? What's going to be the fallout on that? So the problem is, you get a guy like Anthony Fauci, who certainly has the qualifications to tell us medically how this disease works on the body, and yet he seems oblivious to these questions. He told CNN's Anderson Cooper that he doesn't understand why every state hasn't issued a stay-at-home order, and maybe we need a national quarantine to make sure it gets done. And he elsewhere said we can only relax social distancing once there are no more deaths and no more infections. Well, of course, the obvious question is, how long might that be? And what's going to be the cost to society? That is, those questions that we just went over are outside the hard scientists. Now, science plays a role in giving us the facts we need to draw societal conclusions, but they are not the lone voice. And those who think that science is the lone voice here are really espousing a worldview known as scientism more than they are biblical Christianity.
At the same time, I think there are people that would say that when some of those states have not followed the social distancing requirements or shelter in place, they've seen consequences because they didn't do it. So, for instance, there are a few smaller towns in certain states that have giant food processing plants, and at those plants that employ 3,000 people that keep going because they're considered essential or whatnot, you know, more, almost 300 people have been exposed to the coronavirus and have caught COVID-19, and now they're all ill and they have to shut down the whole entire plant, which could impact the food chain supply and distribution for the country.
Sure.
So at the same time, they would say, well, yeah, people have not shut down those states or done those shelters in places where they can, and they have the consequences for not doing so.
Well, the problem is that the science of that is still a bit fuzzy, because we've got the example of cruise ships where people were quarantined together and stuck together for a long period of time, and a few people got the virus, but the vast majority did not. So it's, again, we've got a lot of unknowns here. Now, I'm with you. Morally speaking, walking around and intentionally exposing people to an illness is a moral wrong. We're not divided on that principle, but I am saying the science isn't as known as we would like it to be at this point.
Well, we've been talking a bit about Dr. Anthony Fauci, because he certainly has been a big face of this, you know, encouraging these economic shutdowns as a scientist. He's been very visible on news programs. And one of those was the Today Show. He was arguing for an indefinite economic shutdown to really stop this virus. And he said this, quote, "I know it's difficult, but we're having a lot of suffering, a lot of death. This is inconvenient from an economic standpoint and from a personal standpoint, but we just have to do it." And you have said that his quote is, quote, "breathtaking tunnel vision," unquote. So what is Dr. Fauci overlooking? Because I think a lot of people would resonate with what he's saying.
Yeah. Well, what he's overlooking is 47 million unemployed Americans that are facing financial ruin. That's not an inconvenience. That's a disaster. And if it's sustained, it's going to turn us into a poor country. Poor countries have poor health. More people die of preventable diseases. In fact, in the largest study of its kind, tracing the relationship between mortality and life longevity, what they found was, this was a Yale study, they found a direct correlation between unemployment and mortality. And here's the bottom line of that study. The bottom line of that study is that high unemployment increases mortality and low unemployment decreases it. Economic growth, quoting right here from the study, "Economic growth is the single most important factor relating to length of life," said the principal investigator, Harvey Brenner. And what he went on to say, that is, he ends by saying, "employment is the essential element of social status, and it establishes a person as a contributing member of society and has very important implications for self-esteem and life longevity." And when you take away employment, he says here, and I quote him directly, "when you take away employment, people become susceptible to depression, cardiovascular disease, AIDS, and many other illnesses that increase mortality. Suicide is correlated to unemployment. 40,000 Americans took their lives during the Great Depression, and many of those were men because men take unemployment much harder given the fact that they feel they have a principal role of needing to provide. And that's not just back then that suicide was a correlating factor. After the financial collapse of 2008, there was a study done at the University of Zurich that found a direct link between increased rates of unemployment and suicide. And again, pointing to the fact that men in particular are at risk. If you look at the state of Indiana, as soon as their governor there, Governor Holcomb, introduced the social distancing guidelines and had the shelter in place order put into law, the hotlines in the state, the mental health hotlines, noticed a dramatic spike in action. In fact, their addiction hotlines went from 20 calls a week to getting over 20 calls a day. Gambling hotlines, same thing. They went from 30 a month to over 220 in a week. These are stressful times for people. In fact, stressful may not be the half of it when we think about addictions in particular. When you ban recovery groups due to social distancing guidelines, people who are recovering from drug and alcohol abuse cannot get what they most need, which is connection as an escape from isolation. Isolation is a huge trigger for relapse into addictive behavior. And yet right now, we're forcing millions of addicts into that isolation way of living that, as one national expert put it, Dr. Tim K. Brennan, he said that right now we are facing a national relapse trigger as millions of Americans struggle to stay sober on their own. And then there's also this, Melanie. Ironically, the very directives that were designed to save our medical professions, meaning shutdowns that said, hey, listen, we've got to make sure we have enough hospital beds. We've got to shut the economy down to make sure our hospitals aren't overrun. Those economic shutdowns are now putting hospitals out of business. In fact, one nonprofit research firm said that 43,000 healthcare workers have been laid off since this thing broke out. And when hospitals can't make money off of other surgeries, when they're forced to focus strictly on COVID-19, they start losing money. And the study concluded by saying, we may be looking at hundreds of hospitals closing when this is all over. Now, my point here is not to minimize the death and suffering from the disease. It's to say there is another side of this. The precautionary principle here also applies to what's going to be the catastrophic result from shutting down the economy. And we've got to look at both sides. We can't just say life above profits and think we've solved the issue. It is a bit more complex than that.
The second part of your article deals with pro-life principles that we're talking about earlier. So, are some pro-lifers trading lives for profits when they support opening the economy? That's a thing that we discussed. And, you know, others would say that when you do that, you're going to put vulnerable human beings at risk, people with that have a higher percentage with underlying conditions that might get it, and also people who are, like you were saying, more in marginalized areas or maybe the homeless or something like that. And you argue that we must distinguish between intent and foresight. So why don't you explain that for our listeners?
Sure. When we say that pro-life means we must never intentionally kill an innocent human being, it means that pro-lifers must be committed to a core principle. And that core principle is that human life has intrinsic value. And because it has intrinsic value, we must not ever intentionally kill innocent human beings. That principle is non-negotiable, even when it might profit us in the middle of a pandemic. In fact, I can give you an exact example of this. A few weeks ago, the Democrats began making a proposal that we lift funding restrictions on fetal tissue research on grounds that it would help cure COVID-19. And congressional Democrats in particular began pushing for the Trump administration to lift those funding restrictions. And pro-lifers everywhere said, no way, you cannot do that because we can never support policies that intentionally kill innocent human beings. Therefore, we cannot support lifting the funding restrictions. And that was the right response, because if you're a pro-lifer, while you're certainly committed to finding cures for people, including cures for this virus, you will never support cures at the expense of human life. You will insist that we pursue the treatment of disease in morally acceptable ways. And intentionally killing one human so another can profit isn't an example of doing that. However, there are cases, Melanie, where pro-lifers can foresee the death of an innocent human being, but not intend it, where the action in place is a side effect of something, not something we intend. So an example would be what I gave you earlier, where we drive to work each day, and sure, we can foresee that innocent people might be killed driving, but we do not intend their deaths in any way. Electricians, 400 of them are killed a year providing electricity for us, but we do not think that we're somehow trading lives for profits by having electricity. We mentioned the car example earlier. It's actually a bigger risk when you look at it worldwide. We're talking 1.5 million people a year die in car accidents. We could absolutely save hundreds of thousands of lives if we imposed a global 25-mile-per-hour speed limit. But we don't do that, not because we're playing lifeboat, where we're making an economic decision over whose life has value and whose doesn't. Rather, we recognize that by increasing the speed limit, we get speedy delivery of goods and services that impact everyone for good, and we get a higher standard of living. We don't intend anybody's death by having a higher speed limit, but we can foresee it. And those trade-offs are something we accept all the time.
So you're saying that pro-life means it will never sanction the intentional killing of innocent human beings. It does not mean that the preservation of life is the only intrinsic good that we should pursue. And so I can see some pro-life apologists getting nervous at that statement. So what are you driving at exactly?
Yeah, no, fair question. While we will never intentionally kill an innocent human being, when we say that there are other intrinsic goods we ought to pursue, we're not sacrificing our core principle. And let me give an example of this. Is it an intrinsic good to feed my family? Yes. Is it an intrinsic good to educate my children? Yes. There's just two examples right there. So if we look at the totality of life, and we say the only thing we should pursue is the preservation of life, the longevity of life, well, our decision-making would get a whole lot simpler. All we have to do then is opt for that which increases life expectancy, and we can basically ignore all other considerations. That would make life a whole lot easier. But again, pro-life doesn't mean that. And let me give you an example of what I'm getting at here. If we pursue only life and its extension, that's not necessarily going to lead to the best or even a good outcome. So suppose I'm a poor farmer somewhere living in a secluded part of Georgia, and I raise sweet corn and I raise dairy products, and I scrape by feeding my family of six by selling dairy products and sweet corn. And we've got it pretty rough. We live in very poor housing. My kids are poorly educated. We don't have good social interaction. My kids are never going to travel or go to college. But we have great life expectancy. In fact, life expectancy is 85 years on average, and that's because we have wonderful clean air. And we raise non-processed foods that we not only sell but eat ourselves. And so we're in really good health. Now, let's assume out of the blue, I get a call from Morgan Stanley in New York, and they say, we would like to move your family up here. We are targeting farmers for investment strategies, and we need someone on the inside who knows the farming world that can help us think through this. We need a consultant, and we'll pay you $250,000 a year to come work for us. Your kids will get to go to the best schools. We'll place you in a nice Long Island neighborhood where you'll have excellent church fellowship. Your kids will be part of a thriving youth group. Your wife will get to go out to dinner with you on weekends. And you'll have the money you need to pursue the goods of educating your kids and providing for your family. However, you know there is a caveat, and it's this. Life expectancy on Long Island is 2 years less than where you are in the countryside of Georgia. And the reason is that the air quality is not as good. Now, if I were that farmer and I moved my family to Long Island, knowing that I can foresee, though I don't intend it, I can foresee a shorter lifespan as a possibility, not a guarantee, but a possibility. If I go ahead and move my family anyway, despite that loss of life expectancy, have I traded lives for profits? Not in the way our critics are saying. Rather, what I'm doing is I am saying, look, I am looking at this more holistically. Wrapped up in economic considerations are clusters of other intrinsic goods, like I said earlier, educating my kids, providing for my family, giving to charity, building my marriage, pursuing Christian fellowship. All of these things contribute to the common good and are part of what we ought to think of when we think of profits.
So basically, you're challenging us to think through what profits really mean, because right now we think of it in just a very narrow way.
Yeah, correct? People tend to just frame this as cold, hard cash. Look, I'm willing to throw granny under the bus to keep my 401k healthy. And that's clearly not what is going on here. What we're saying is there are trade-offs where we don't intend innocent human lives to perish, but we can foresee it happening. And by the way, no matter which way we decide on this, we're going to see that trade-off. And therefore, pro-lifers who look at it holistically and say, we cannot prevent all death from happening. We can't do that. And our principles don't require that we do that. Rather, we look at it and say, we will never intentionally kill innocent human beings. We will support no policies that advocate for that. But we're also not saying that the longevity of life is the only intrinsic good here. There are other intrinsic goods, clusters of intrinsic goods wrapped up in what it means to have profits. So our economic worldview needs to be more than just cold, hard cash. We've got to look at these other intrinsic goods that I mentioned with the example I just gave.
So do you think that this divide of views as it relates to the COVID-19 situation that we're having within the pro-life community, do you think it's going to last, or do you think, you know, whenever they find a vaccine of COVID-19, it'll go away?
That is an excellent question, Melanie, and I'm not entirely sure. I do think it has brought to the surface a larger debate within the pro-life community of what it means to be pro-life, and that debate has already been going on for a while. For example, there's been a debate about whether pro-life means we have to be whole life, meaning we take on a whole bunch of issues besides abortion. We not only take on abortion, we take on solving poverty, we take on building healthy marriages, we take on immigration reform that allows for more liberalized immigration laws, and the list goes on and on. Then there are pro-lifers like myself who would argue, no, pro-life is better to be understood as we oppose the intentional killing of innocent human beings, and abortion is the primary way that's happening in our culture today. Therefore, that's what we need to focus on. Now, Christians, of course, as a whole, will focus on many issues, but it doesn't follow the operational objectives of the pro-life movement have to be broadly applied the way our Christian ethics would be broadly applied. So there's that debate. And I think what's happening with COVID-19 is only going to bring that debate further to the surface. And it's going to be interesting how this plays out. What I'm hopeful about is that a discussion about human life is coming to the surface. You mentioned Andrew Cuomo in your remarks earlier. And you're right, he is a contradiction in terms in many ways, because we look at him, here's a governor who is now saying we should not ever forget the primacy of human life. Okay, and I hear that and I go, great. On the other hand, we got a guy that never saw an abortion he didn't like. He signs into legislation a law that not only permits abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy, but strips babies who survive abortion from any protections. This is not a guy who is pro-life the way we'd like to think of him being pro-life. On the other hand, I actually share a little bit of your optimism that this might be the beginning of a wake-up call for him. And I don't think we should be so critical of guys like him that we just dismiss their concerns for human life as totally invalid because look at his position on abortion. No, I think what we do is say, okay, good. Maybe this starts to awaken him a bit. At least that would be my prayer.
So I think you're right. I think there have been different events and different things happening in the last, 5 years or so that has made the pro-life community start to have various different debates on framing what that means to be pro-life, as we've talked about in this particular episode. So how can pro-life advocates continue to sharpen themselves during the shutdown as we discuss these things? I mean, how do we use our time wisely?
I think the most important thing to do right now, when we're not allowed to go to work, when we can't pursue other intrinsic goods we'd like to pursue, is we ought to build our minds as Christian thinkers. And it's one of the reasons I appreciate your podcast and the work that you do, Melanie, because that's what you're committed to. And one of the ways we can do that is we can use this time to master the moral logic of the pro-life position. And it's very tempting in today's social media culture to have short attention spans, not devote the time we need to think through difficult issues. And as a result, we end up being very shallow in our opinions, and we almost end up becoming part of an outrage culture that the minute we see something on social media we don't like, we have to react with a great deal of heat. I think there is a place for using this time to step back a little bit. I don't mean trash your Twitter account, but I do mean step back a little bit and say, what can I do to build my mind as a Christian thinker? So here are a couple of suggestions. It's an excellent time to read a book like Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, that talks about how our current culture distracts us from deep learning and thinking deeply. And then to read some good pro-life apologetics material, books like Frank Beckwith's book, Defending Life. You might look at my book, The Case for Life, or Peter Kreft's book, The Unaborted Socrates, or Pat Lee's book, Abortion and Unborn Human Life. These are all books that are accessible to lay readers, that spending a little bit of time with them will help you master the moral logic of a Christian worldview on abortion and topics like it. And I think we have to do that, Melanie, because we're in a position now where we are all apologists. It used to be that we could leave the defense of the pro-life position to a bunch of experts who would speak for us. They'd show up as talking heads in the media. And by the way, you know, Roe v. Wade was making sure that none of us really had a say on this issue anyway. The federal courts had already decided it. Our individual states didn't have a lot of voice on this. Well, that's now changing, because now what's happening is the courts are signaling, we don't know to what extent they'll actually do this, but they're signaling that they're going to return a measure of the decision-making on abortion to individual states. That means all of us need to be equipped to step up and make the case to our friends, our neighbors, our family members as to why we're pro-life. And it's not hard to do. You simply argue that it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Abortion does that. Therefore, it's wrong. And it doesn't take a whole lot of work to master that moral logic, but master it we must.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Scott that I've been asking our authors during the pandemic right now. And the first one is, with the shelter in place, are you eating healthy food or comfort food?
Great question. Actually, surprisingly more healthy. I'm shocked at myself.
I think you're the first person who has said more healthy. And the second question, of course, as we know, just because of all this happening, there's a lot of shortages of various things. One of those is toilet paper. Mainly, the shortage, I found out from reading an article, is not so much that people are hoarding, which some people are, but the fact that there's two different kinds of manufacturing of toilet paper, one less nice toilet paper that goes to, you know, businesses and restaurants and so forth, and then stuff for residents. So there's not enough residential toilet paper factories making it. So I guess the question for everyone wants to know is, at your house, do you guys hang toilet paper over or under?
Definitely over.
I think that's a majority sentiment that I've been hearing. Well, thanks for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast, Scott.
Thank you, Melanie.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Scott Klusendorf, and he has written an online exclusive viewpoint opinion piece called COVID-19, Do Pro-Life Principles Require a Sustained Shutdown of the Economy? Who decides? You can read Scott's article completely free on our website, equip.org.
We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Anagraph, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Anagraph, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK. Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.